The election of 1920 was memorable for at least one reason. It marked the first time that Americans, tired of the high-minded idealism and sacrifice of the war years, were eager to get back to normal and welcomed the excitement of an election year. The Republican convention was in a stalemate for a while. There were too many able contenders for the candidacy. Finally, after an all-night conference in the traditional smoke-filled room, the party bosses trotted out a dark horse to break the deadlock. Thus, Warren G. Harding became the candidate. Everyone was surprised, even Harding himself. A small-town newspaper man, his record as senator from Ohio had been undistinguished. The Republican leaders saw in Harding a man they thought they could control, and they appeared to be right. The Democrats, meeting in California, chose Governor James M. Cox of Ohio to run against Harding. Like Harding, Cox was a former newspaper man, but there the resemblance ended. Where Harding was unimaginative and easily influenced, Cox was a crusading progressive in the Wilson tradition. Cox's running mate as candidate for the vice presidency was a handsome young New Yorker named Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The vote was an unusually light one, but it was heavily in favor of Harding. Even Tennessee, a Democratic stronghold by tradition, supported the Republican ticket. Harding's administration, with normalcy as the watchword, set out to abolish federal wartime powers, to establish high tariffs, and to return the country to a peacetime basis as soon as possible. His cabinet was filled with a mixture of honest, capable men and a group of political hangers-on who used the president's weakness to their own advantage. The most notable achievement of Harding's administration was the International Conference on Limitation of Arms. On Armistice Day, 1921, the delegates from England, France, Japan, Italy, and the United States gathered in Washington to hear President Harding address them.
Gentlemen of the conference, the United States welcomes you with unselfish hands. The world demands a sober contemplation of the existing order and the realization that there can be no cure without sacrifice, not by one of us, but by all of us. I do not mean surrendered rights or narrowed freedom or denied aspirations or ignored national necessities. Our republic would no more ask for these than it would give. No pride need be humbled. No nationality submerged. But I would have emergence of minds committing all of us to less preparation for war and more enjoyment of fortunate peace.
In the summer of 1923, after heading an administration beset by scandal, Harding died suddenly and mysteriously in California. Calvin Coolidge became president. Coolidge was a man of few pretensions and fewer words. His personality, in contrast to Harding's naive geniality, was conservative and aloof, almost dour. Someone observed jokingly that he had probably been weaned on a pickle. He received news of Harding's death while on vacation in Vermont. It was 2 o'clock in the morning when the message came, and with typical Yankee thoroughness, he went directly into the kerosene-lit parlor of his family's farmhouse and took the oath of office as president, administered by his father, the local justice of the peace. Coolidge purged the dishonest elements of the Harding administration out of the government, and with the help of a national prosperity, went on to become an immensely popular president in spite of his lack of personal glamour. In 1924, he was nominated for another term. The Democrats, violently split on the issue of the Ku Klux Klan, were deadlocked between Alfred E. Smith and William Gibbs McAdoo. Finally, after 102 ballots, the convention in New York's Madison Square Garden named John W. Davis, a brilliant New York lawyer, as the Democratic candidate. The Republican campaign was built largely on the pleasures of prosperity that the nation was enjoying under its administration. Coolidge avoided the limelight, even refusing a degree of Doctor of Laws from Yale University on the grounds that he didn't want the publicity. In one of his rare campaign speeches, he said,
"I believe in the American Constitution. I favor the American system of individual enterprise. And I am opposed to any general extension of government ownership and control. I believe not only in advocating economy in public expenditure, but in its practical application and actual accomplishment. I believe in a reduction and reform of taxation and shall continue my efforts in that direction. I am in favor of protection. I believe in the permanent court and further limitation of armaments. I am opposed to aggressive war. I shall avoid involving ourselves in the political controversies of Europe, but I shall do what I can to encourage American citizens and resources to assist in restoring Europe with the sympathetic support of our government. I want agriculture and industry on a sound basis of prosperity and equality. I shall continue to strive for the economic, moral, and spiritual welfare of my country. The laws of the land are being and will continue to be enforced.
Mr. Coolidge's careful reading and almost painful elocution may have sounded weak in comparison to Davis's fiery speeches and charges of corruption in government, but the Republican slogan, "Keep cool and keep Coolidge," echoed public sentiment, and Coolidge won by a landslide vote of almost 16 million. Coolidge's inaugural address, the first ever broadcast by radio, stressed his viewpoint that the safest policy was that of the middle of the road, and his administration carried that idea out by scrupulously refraining from interference with private enterprise. Prosperity reached new heights. In 1928, Coolidge's popularity was still strong, and it came as a shock to the Republicans and to a large part of the nation when, at a press conference, he handed the reporters gathered around him each a slip of paper that read, "I do not choose to run for president in 1928. Perhaps he saw the shadows of the coming depression and chose not to shoulder the burden. Perhaps he was tired of the political fanfare he had had to put up with. Whatever the reason, he meant what he said. And Herbert Hoover became the Republican nominee. Running against Hoover was Al Smith, the happy warrior. Smith, the immensely popular governor of New York, was nominated for the third time in 8 years before the convention, and this time he won it, but he didn't win the presidency. Herbert Hoover, wealthy and eminently respected, had a long record of public service behind him. Before the World War, he had distinguished himself by rescuing over 200,000 Americans stranded in Europe. And after the war, he had become even more of a hero by marshaling billions of dollars of international funds to feed the starving victims of the war in Belgium and France. In one of his campaign speeches, Mr. Hoover reminded a nation quick to forget the horrors of war that peace is something to be cherished.
There is much that we must not forget. Amid the afterglow of glory and legend, we forget the filth and the stench and the death of the trenches. We forget the dumb grief of mothers, of wives, and of children. We forget the unending blight cast on the world by sacrifice of the flower of every race. I was one of the few civilians who saw something of the Battle of the Somme. In the distant view were the unending trenches filled with 1.5 million of men. Here and there, like ants, they advanced under the thunder and the belching of volcanoes from 10,000 guns. Their lives were thrown away until 500,000 of them had died. Passing close by were the unending lines of men plodding along the right-hand side of the road to the front, not with drums and bands, but with saddened resignation. And down the left side of the road came the unending lines of wounded men, staggering among stretchers and ambulances. Do you think one can forget that?
Hoover won the election with the promise of a chicken in every pot, two cars in every garage, and prosperity and more prosperity. Radios, Al Smith called them radios, blared the speeches and promises of both candidates across the nation, and more people heard the candidates' voices in that campaign than had heard all the other presidential candidates in the nation's history put together. Hoover's promise of more and more prosperity didn't come true. Less than 7 months after his inauguration in 1929, the crash came. It came fast and it came hard, and the nation hit economic rock bottom. Herbert Hoover's 4 years in the presidency brought him an increasing unpopularity with every day. "Brother, can you spare a dime?" became the national motto, and millions were idle all over the country. In 1930, real despair set in, and the administration blamed international forces as the reason for the Depression. Yet the Republicans, within their own party, were fair enough to see that the Depression was not of Hoover's making. He received the nomination again in 1932. Running against him on the Democratic platform was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the dynamic, progressive, and liberal-minded governor of New York whose political career was already skyrocketing. The entire Democratic machine roared into action, and victory was assured by Roosevelt's platform that promised unemployment relief, old age insurance, labor legislation, help for the farmer, conservation, development of power resources, a balanced budget, sound currency, and repeal of prohibition, and, above all, hope for a brighter future. It could all be wrapped up in a single phrase. I pledge you, I pledge myself, said Roosevelt, to a new deal for the American people. In one of his electrifying campaign speeches, Mr. Roosevelt spoke out in defense of the presidency, but not in defense of the then president, when he said,
I deplore the tendency to blame all of our present troubles on the president. He is perhaps the victim of a theory which holds that the control of the Republican Party entitles the holders of the reins to use that historic party for the purpose of personal gain. He and his associates have perhaps shown a lack of high capacity to contribute leadership in the solving of a national crisis. The battle of the democracy is pointed not at the rank and file of the Republican Party, but at those who today direct its policy. But the battle of the democracy can never tolerate abuse heaped against the person of the President of the United States.
With Roosevelt's election in 1932, the entire destiny of the nation changed. Through drastic emergency measures, Roosevelt slowly began to restore America's self-confidence. Though his enemies were numerous and outspoken, his popularity surpassed that of any president since his Republican fourth cousin, Theodore Roosevelt. In 1936, he was nominated for a second term, this time being opposed by Alfred M. Landon, the governor of Kansas, who presented no real threat to Roosevelt's re-election. Sunflowers, the emblem of the Landon campaign, blossomed on lapels across America. At one leading New York jeweler's, wealthy Republican ladies could buy gold sunflowers studded with yellow diamonds for $815. But Landon, the silent Coolidge from Kansas, they called him, and all his sunflowers, was no match for FDR's million-dollar smile and spellbinding voice. The 1936 election went to the Democrats by a landslide. Rumblings of war in Europe were getting louder. In making his policy on war unmistakably clear, Roosevelt said in 1937,
America hates war. America... America hopes for peace. Therefore, America actively engages in the search for peace.
In 1940, Franklin Delano Roosevelt broke one of the most firmly established of all our presidential traditions by becoming a candidate for a third consecutive term in the White House. War by this time was a reality in Europe, and it was felt by many that it was no time to change national leadership when the international situation looked so grim. But many disagreed on the grounds that in a democracy, no single man is indispensable. The Republicans, after long debate, chose Wendell Willkie, the brilliant and forceful corporation lawyer and utilities executive from Indiana, as their candidate. This time, Roosevelt had some real competition. Willkie was not only enormously popular all over the nation, he professed many of the same political beliefs that had been considered the private property of the New Dealers. But FDR, with the controversial Henry Wallace as his vice presidential running mate, soared to a third victory. His third term had not run a year when war came suddenly to the United States. Japan had attacked Pearl Harbor, and Roosevelt said, "We are now in this war. We are in it all the way." During the war, he made many speeches before Congress and before the nation, always giving courage and always proving his remarkable powers of leadership. One of his most moving speeches wasn't a speech at all. It was a prayer delivered on D-Day, June 6th, 1944.
With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace. A peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
Once more in 1944, Roosevelt ran again for the presidency. This time, traditionalists were outraged. A third term, perhaps, but a fourth term, never. But with Harry S. Truman as candidate for vice president, Roosevelt won another crashing majority, this time against Thomas E. Dewey, governor of New York. Dewey's campaign was hard-hitting and often hit where it hurt. In his memorable speech before the Teamsters Union, Roosevelt hit back.
These Republican leaders have not been content with attacks on me or on my wife or on my sons. No, not content with that. They now include my little dog, Fallon.
Franklin Roosevelt died on April 12, 1945, at the very beginning of the fourth term for which he had fought so hard. Harry S. Truman, the former senator from Missouri, joined the ranks of Theodore Roosevelt and Calvin Coolidge as vice presidents who became president in the way that no man wants to win the office. Truman was a humble man, and the burden he suddenly had to shoulder seemed staggering. A hurried call had brought him to the White House. There he received from Mrs. Roosevelt the quiet and shocking announcement that the president was dead. 2 hours later, with little formality or protocol, he was sworn into office. I had come to see the president, Mr. Truman recalls in his memoirs. Now, having repeated that simply worded oath, I myself was president. Truman's sincerity soon won him the respect of the nation. The end of the war was in sight. On August 6th, 1945, the first atomic bomb was dropped over Hiroshima. Here is President Truman's brief and dramatic radio announcement.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to mass war.
In 1948, Truman threw his broad-brimmed hat into the ring. Running against him was Thomas E. Dewey in his second try for the presidency. The Republicans, this time sure of victory, didn't waste too much effort on the campaign. Truman, with characteristic determination and candor, set out on a tour across the country telling the voters,
I'm Harry S. Truman. I work for the government, and I'm trying to keep my job. We're out to win this election, and we're going to do that on the second day of November.
And he won. Everybody, the Republicans, many Democrats, the poll takers, and the commentators, was surprised. Everybody, that is, except Mr. Truman.
I had my sandwich and glass of buttermilk and went to bed at 6:30. And along about 12 o'clock, I happened to wake up for some reason, and the radio was turned on, and Mr. Kelton Barn was saying, well, the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote. We have yet to win. And we are very sure that when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by an overwhelming majority. And I went back to bed and went to sleep.
Harry Truman besides being an astute politician and an energetic administrator, had many other talents that made him a memorable chief executive. One of these is a rare talent indeed, and we hear him demonstrate it now. In the 1952 election, the Democrats nominated Adlai E. Stevenson, governor of Illinois, a man of polish and humor and liberal thought. Running against him on the Republican ticket was General Dwight D. Eisenhower, one of the great popular heroes of our time. Stevenson conducted a forthright and effective campaign, but the general's popularity, coupled with the Republicans' persuasive argument that it was time for a change, made an unbeatable combination. Eisenhower was elected. When it became obvious that the election was over, he made this statement before his jubilant followers.
I am not certain, my friends, whether or not you have read or heard the telegram that Mr. Stevenson just sent to me. It reads, "The people have made their choice, and I congratulate you. That you may be the servant and guardian of peace and make the day of trouble a door of hope is my earnest prayer. Best wishes, Adlai Stevenson." Just as I came down to the ballroom, I replied to that telegram as follows. I thank you for your courteous and generous message. Recognizing the intensity of the difficulties that lie ahead, it is clearly necessary that men and women of goodwill of both parties forget the political strife through which we have passed and devote themselves to the single purpose of a better future. This, I believe, they will do. Signed with my name.
President Eisenhower's administration following the 1952 election has seen many changes in the international scene. The Geneva Conference in 1955 brought new hope of world peace, and we heard the president make this statement.
We will try to explore the reasons why this world doesn't seem to get closer to peace and to try to find roads that if the world follows, all of you may live a little bit more tranquilly than have the people of my generation.
Mr. Eisenhower's health has been a prime concern recently to everyone in the country. Following his heart attack, there was much speculation as to whether he would become a candidate in the 1956 election. His own announcement of his decision was made at a White House press conference in which he said,
"My answer will be positive, that is, affirmative."
And so 1956 brings us another presidential election year. It's been happening every 4 years since 1788, and it will keep on happening. Each time, it reaffirms the faith of all Americans in the democratic principles for which this republic stands. It's our government in action, and each of us can take a part in it and be proud. Those who are too young to vote can prepare for the day when they can cast their first ballots. For thousands of Americans, that thrill will come for the first time this year. Those who are already voters will go to the polls knowing that no matter which candidate they vote for, their voice will be heard in the government. And to the winner, our next president, we say, hail to the chief.